Mr. Pivovar, good morning to you.
Good morning, Chief Judge. May it please the court, getting appellate arguments about 100 times, I think, and this is only the second time I've ever heard the Attorney General's office agree with me or write and agree with me.
It's kind of a nice feeling, isn't it?
It is a wonderful feeling. But it puts you in a secondary position of wondering, what are you guys thinking?
Mr. Pivovar, just as a matter of note, please don't refer to the court as you guys.
But the Honorable Justices. This matter was remanded in November of 2014. This court had heard the previous appeal wherein the trial court had denied an evidentiary hearing to Mr. Payne. This court remanded it with direction. It indicated to the trial court that basically he was to proceed. He was to proceed on the basis of giving Mr. Payne a evidentiary hearing to determine determine only one issue. Mr. Payne had initially raised 5 issues at the in his initial pleading to the court, which was filed in 2012. So this has been around for 5 years. The court found that he waived all claims of ineffective assistance to counsel except his claim that counsel was ineffective in advising him. At that point, prior appointed counsel representing Mr. Payne for a while down in Sark County District Court, and the matter just hung around for a while. I was appointed as substitute counsel. Met with Mr. Payne, and Mr. Payne indicated that he thought the court's opinion was that he could proceed on all 5 issues. In order to try and clarify that position, I filed the pleading with the district court to try and determine the parameters of the evidentiary hearing to be held pursuant to After that hearing was held, the court came out and said that the parameters of the hearing were to be that I was present evidence regarding whether his counsel had failed to file an appeal in this matter.
Had that even been assigned as one of the grounds for ineffective assistance of counsel in any of your client's post-conviction motions?
It had not. And not only had it not, but it had been specifically dealt with by the court in its previous decision. They said in that previous decision, they decided that the counsel had failed to withdraw and therefore did have an obligation to file an appeal on behalf of Mr. Payne. And therefore, he was going to be allowed to proceed with this particular issue of claim of ineffective and not advising him on his plea of no contest.
Wasn't it that he had the same counsel at the time that the appeal would have been filed as trial counsel? It was the same lawyer.
Exactly.
And generally, we assume that a lawyer will not raise his or her own error on appeal.
Correct. So, at the point that the trial court indicated that I needed to file an appeal or test whether counsel had failed to file the appeal, I presumed it was a needless step, in my opinion. So at that point, I appealed it to this court to hopefully get a remand with direction again.
Is the essence being that which was scheduled didn't comport to the mandate?
Correct.
Okay.
And the law on that is, you know, is long settled that if it doesn't comport with the mandate, that judge has no ability to do anything that the mandate didn't tell me.
So it's your position that the court's order was void?
The trial court's order, correct. And
I should have been more specific.
And I should not use prior language. So, it would be my opinion that it would create a needless step. I would have to bring trial counsel's failure to file an appeal, and then in that appeal, if I was granted that appeal by the trial judge, I would have to raise all the issues which the court has already looked at in Payne 1 over again, because my client would insist on that. If he's given his appeal, he'll say, well, now you can raise these issues. I don't think that's what the court intended in Payne 1. I think the court intended in Payne 1 that you look only at this issue of whether his plea was knowingly and voluntarily.
Don't you start over on some of this stuff when you get a direct appeal? And during that direct appeal, then, aren't you required to make the assignments of error that occurred in the trial court?
I believe that would be...
And if one of them was ineffective assistance of counsel, you'd be required to raise that, wouldn't you? And you'd raise all the other claims that you would normally raise, that if you didn't raise them, you would be barred.
Exactly. But that's not what the mandate of Payne 1 told the trial judge to do. I think the mandate of Payne 1 indicated that the only issue he has left is whether trial counsel was ineffective in inviting him to plead to the contest.
And counsel, in Payne 1, the court was looking at the post-conviction motions themselves and the allegations there, correct? And there was not an allegation seeking a new direct appeal.
Correct.
That simply wasn't the sort of relief that Mr. Payne was requesting.
Correct. The trial court looked at all five issues that he raised in his initial post-conviction proceeding in Payne 1. And after deciding that trial counsel was ineffective in failing to file an appeal or in not withdrawing from the case, really, after finding that, they had no option but to say the only thing he has here is the plea of no contest, whether that was proper. Unless there's other questions, I would ask the court to remand this with a specific direction, only to proceed on the one issue of his claim of ineffective counsel advising. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Mr. List, good morning to you.
List Court, U.S. Assistant Attorney General, here on behalf of the Appalachian State of Nebraska. We agree the district court there by ordering an evidentiary hearing on the claim of whether counsel was ineffective for not filing a new direct appeal. That claim was never raised or addressed throughout this case. It wasn't part of this court's mandate. Basis to reject that claim below.
Was that order a final order?
The district court's order granting that evidentiary hearing. If I recall the case law and the language in the case law dealing with scope of mandate, I believe it says something to the effect of an order that goes beyond and does something other than what's mandated by an appellate court. Lower court lacks jurisdiction to do that. And if that's the case, if I'm recalling the language correctly, then I guess the order would be an nullity if you have jurisdiction to enter it, I assume.
And if it is void and a nullity, is it a final order, final appealable order?
Well, when I try to think through all the circumstances of what constitutes final appealable order, I mean, one of which is that it affects your substantial rights. I guess if a defendant views that order as one that has granted an evidentiary hearing on one claim in the post-conviction contest. You've been granted an evidentiary hearing on one claim and arguably denied it on others. That would certainly affect your substantial right because you're going to potentially in the future lack jurisdiction to appeal from the denial of those claims, if that's how this is construed.
So that's the path that you think gets us to a final appealable order?
If the path does lead us there, yes, I think that would be the path. I would certainly say if I were in Mr. Pivovar's shoes, I certainly would have appealed it.
Counsel, if this is a final order, aren't we going backwards in the jurisprudence on final orders and allowing piecemeal litigation on these post-conviction actions?
Well, I mean...
Well, what if a judge doesn't grant, let's just take your standard run-of-the-mill post-conviction, there's five assigned errors, the judge only grants a hearing on one, then do those other four become appealable before the hearing on the one?
Yeah. So our post-conviction proceeding already allows for these. That's an interlocutory, that's the final appeal order that allows
under our case law.
Right. So in that regard, we do allow piecemeal litigation.
We crossed that bridge years ago, in other words.
We have, yes. And I think, again, if there's a path that takes us there, I think that would be it. I haven't disputed that this was appealable order. We take no issue with that. We're really just here to seek clarification on the scope of remand here and what we need to do moving forward to ensure that things get addressed. The only other point I would make, apart from the direct appeal issue, we agree with Alan on that one. But I do think if the court's inclined, I think some additional clarification on the scope of your remand might be helpful when this goes back down. I was looking back through the defendant's motion as well as this court's opinion in Petting 1, and the language in this court's opinion says that he has the one remaining claim of ineffective assistance of counsel, i.e. whether counsel is ineffective for advising to plead no contest. And then we have the five subparts, the five separate independent claims of ineffective assistance of counsel that he's also alleged. And so I guess there could be some potential confusion in terms of, do we just have the one freestanding claim of counsel ineffective for advising the individual contest, or are these other five claims encompassed within that claim? I think that there was already some confusion on that. And there could be, again,
What's the state's position on whether the others are encompassed or sort of swallowed up?
Sure. In reading back through the defendant's motion again yesterday, he certainly alleges and argues each of those five claims as having affected his decision to enter the plea, because he was saying that his counsel had done all those things, or not done them, whatever, that he either would have received a pretrial discharge or obtained favorable information that would have led him to go to trial rather than entering his plea. So at least as he's alleged those claims, I think there's certainly a good argument from his end that the overarching claim of it affecting his plea subsumes or includes these other five claims as well. And I would note that at least in the very end of your opinion in page 1, it does say, after saying the ineffective claim is not barred, as such, his claims, plural, are not barred. So again, I just pointing out that I think there could be some confusion there as a matter of candor.
So you don't actually have a position.
I'm sorry?
You don't actually have a position on whether one claim survives or five claims survive.
Well,
I guess I'm hearing you say it's a single claim with multiple subparts. Am I wrong?
No, you're not wrong. I guess that's how I'm viewing this. And what I'm saying is, as a matter of candor, when I read his five subparts and the way that he's alleged them, they all seem to, at least as alleged, go toward his overarching claim that his plea was not valid because of ineffective assistance of counsel. In other words,
you're saying that, if I've got it, pardon me, that subsumes a lot of other stuff, like your defense is weak, I have no witnesses, an appeal would be unnecessary, whatever else a lawyer might say in candor to his or her client.
Right. It's not always going to encompass everything. But when you have a claim like the one with the speedy trial claim, where somebody's saying, hey, look, if my counsel had moved for a speedy trial discharge and I would have been successful, I never would have entered that plea because my whole case would have disappeared. It's difficult for me to say that case doesn't affect somebody's decision to enter the plea.
Is that claim procedurally barred by the absence of a direct appeal, though?
Well, I think you've already resolved that and said no. Sorry, bud.
No, I'm finished. Please.
Oh, okay. I mean, as I read Payne 1, that claim has already been found not to be procedural. procedurally barred. I took a run at that last time and argued all these claims were barred and lost. So I'm not going back there again. I wasn't intending to. I think it's preserved as I read Payne 1, and I think that issue's done.
So you're saying, what's the meaning of Payne 1?
I think it would be helpful, in my opinion, if the court's willing to clarify that. If I were a district court judge dealing with this situation and I'm reading Payne 1, I would probably be granting evidentiary hearing on all five of those lines. If you intend something different, I think it's clarification.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Do we have time for rebuttal?
1 minute
and 37 seconds, Mr. Pibblebaugh.
Thank
you very much, and thank you for your service as an appointed lawyer. That concludes arguments for today. The court is adjourned, and you are excused.